Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journey.
I can't stress the value of having a strong team enough. I mean, you think about venture capitalists, a lot of them are investing just in the people more than the idea, and I think that's absolutely true in these settings where it's hard, I mean, where business is tough. You know, I mean, starting up an organization, you know, no matter what your purpose and executing on it really relies on the strength of the people that you have. There's a kind of an imperative to be capturing what we're doing well. So building these systems that I mentioned, capturing what we're doing, ensuring it, sort of disseminating it and influencing the sector. Because frankly, if we're just a chain of 10 or 20 hospitals, that's a drop in the bucket. And I think that's true for a lot of people trying to deal with, you know, whether you're building schools or hospitals, your ability to directly influence the population is just, you know, we would delivering 20 or 30,000 babies is a tiny percentage of the total market. So the only way that we're really going to budge the needle on maternal health is through influence.
I'm very pleased today to have an opportunity to speak to Nick Pearson, founder and executive director of Jacaranda Health. Jacaranda Health provides affordable, high-quality maternal and child health care services to poor women in Kenya. Jacaranda aims to build a fully sustainable and scalable chain of maternity care clinics using the latest technology, business and clinical innovations, and use this experience to help change the way maternity services are provided for the more than 1 million poor women giving birth each year in urban East Africa. Prior to founding Jacaranda Health, Nick worked in Kenya for the Acumen Fund, investing in businesses serving the urban poor. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us today and to talk on Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. Can you tell me a little bit about Jacaranda Health and how you came to set it up?
Sure, Virgil. I've always worked at the intersection of business and social causes. My dad was in the Foreign Service, so as we grew up, we were living in different countries, and it's always been sort of an expectation of mine that I'd be working overseas. And after I went to business school in the U.S., I'd been working for a couple of different organizations that were doing some interesting work at the at the interface between global health and sort of business and finance. And so we were looking at supply chains for clean water supplies in Vietnam and India. And I ended up in Nairobi working for an organization called the Acumen Fund, which is now called Acumen. And they do a really interesting, great organization that does social venture capital investment. So they actually act like venture capitalists. And they place investments in private companies that are serving low-income populations. And they're working in Pakistan and India and West Africa, but they also have this East Africa hub. And I was there looking for investments for them. While I was there, a couple of things happened that became the genesis of Jacaranda. One was that I met my wife, who's an obstetrician from here in San Francisco, and she was working in Western Kenya and had been working with women there. And her stories of the work she was doing with women and the challenges that they had kind of accessing decent quality maternity care was very compelling to me. You end up getting, there's a lot of kind of issues and causes to get behind, and all of them are good, but ultimately you end up sort of landing on one that resonates with you particularly. Decent quality maternity care became something that was something that I was passionate about. At the same time, on the kind of business and opportunity side, we were seeing at Acumen as we were investigating the market, there was a huge need for a better quality care for low income populations. So, the quality of healthcare in general and particularly maternity care was really poor. Women, either didn't have access to care or they went to care in a public hospital or some of these in the private sector. There was a private sector that was catering to the very rich, and sort of a lot of quackery for the very poor. There's a large gap in the market for sort of better quality, more systematic care.
I ended up making the leap from the kind of venture side over to launching this organization, partly inspired by The Gap and partly inspired by my wife and the work she was doing.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the challenges, structural challenges and other, in the provision of maternity care in Kenya?
You know, what you described about the sort of disparities between Europe and Kenya, I think, is a stark example. And it reflects a system that's not operating very effectively. And how that manifests itself is that, a woman goes into a maternity hospital and, it's overcrowded, the quality of care is not respectful, and the level of training and competency of the providers is highly variable as well. So as a result, you get not treated particularly well, the outcomes and the sort of diagnoses aren't as solid, and, the basic supplies and equipment is there. And the outcomes are poor, honestly. So that's where that's where we see an opportunity to kind of to improve the model. We're looking essentially at trying to create a set of systems within a network of our own facilities that can provide higher quality and more affordable care. And be it sort of a demonstration for sort of better opportunities and ways of delivering care in these low resource settings.
I suppose when you were thinking about the level of care that you were going to be able to offer, how did you think about that? And also, to what degree were you thinking about whether or not you would be a non-profit or a for-profit or some kind of hybrid?
It's one thing to say, hey, we want to provide high-quality, low-cost care that's respectable. The implementation of that is more complicated. And really, the only way that you can do that, and the only way that you can, I think, succeed in a lot of these markets where you're just dealing with significant constraints in terms of money and people's ability to pay, is to be extremely efficient. And so we have a very strong focus on building systems, and those are the same kinds of systems that that businesses like Walmart and FedEx and some of the fast food chains use to drive down the costs and improve kind of the systematization of their processes.
Right.
So on our side, it's things like the very tight clinical protocols that are evidence based. The smart use of human resources, and so allocating tasks to people who can do it but are sort of what's called in the health landscape task shifting. So getting kind of lower cost health workers to take on chunks of work, allocating the tasks among them and creating teams that can provide low cost care, really smart logistics, the use of technology and mobile phones, which are prevalent in these environments. So we communicate with our patients via SMS. We have we've built a strong back end where we can kind of track patients that our community mobilizers are out there logging in patients with mobile phones, registering them in the system, and then our guys at headquarters can call them up and do a sort of a sales pitch, and then we can follow up with the patients as they go through our system. So, the use of technology, the use of protocols, the smart use of human resources, those are the kinds of things that drive efficiencies and enable us to operate cheaply and successfully in a place like I think a lot of social entrepreneurs are faced with this question kind of off the bat is should I start as a nonprofit? Should I start as a for-profit? And there are a lot of great examples of both out there in the landscape. And ultimately, I think that decision should not be a dogmatic one. I think sometimes it becomes one. It's like, it's for-profit is better, nonprofit is better. The reality is that I think the right decision is highly contextual. And it depends on the industry and the kind of margins that you can get. So if you really want to serve low-income people, but it costs a decent amount, some types of social services, there's just a fair amount of capital expenditure involved. So healthcare is one of them. Education is another, where it may very well be challenging to run it as a for-profit model. In our case, we launched as a nonprofit We have a for-profit subsidiary in Kenya, but we're essentially a nonprofit. And the reason for that was just that there was a lot of R&D involved in building these systems. And also, we wanted to maintain a strong focus on serving the poorest women. So, in healthcare, it can be tempting to kind of move upmarket if you have for-profit investors. And I've seen that sort of pressure in sort of for-profit social enterprises where you have, where you have shareholders who are like, well, we need better margins now. Our cash flow is tight. And it's the same service. You can kind of move to serving middle-income women. It's just not what I was interested in off the bat. And then, as I mentioned, there's a decent amount of R&D, which is hard to return to investors just in terms of building new systems. So that was our decision at the time. I've seen people do it other ways. I don't have a particular dogma about it.
That makes a lot of sense. When you had this idea, how did you test the feasibility? Because many people listening to this will have an idea or think there's an opportunity and so forth. How did you go about testing the hypothesis, the idea that you there was something that could be done?
Yeah, I mean, this gets down to, this is the fundamental challenge that any entrepreneur has, whether you're nonprofit or for-profit. You're trying to create something out of nothing. It's about bootstrapping. And what, in our case, what that consisted of was three things. Trying to demonstrate some real results as quickly as possible. And in our case, I just out of pocket funded a couple of, team of guys here in Kenya very cheaply to do a bunch of focus groups with some of the women that we serve. So try and get as much feedback as quickly as possible from the women that we were going to serve. We had identified what seemed like a need, but really wanted to make sure that it was there. And so as those focus groups came in and we saw kind of people's real experiences and the needs and the gaps that they described, it became clearer that there was a gap in the market. The question of whether or not there was something that you could build a business model off of takes, again, a sort of another kind of testing and piloting. And in our case, we started out, right now we run small maternity hospitals, but we started out with a mobile clinic, for example. So we were just providing prenatal and postnatal care and family planning. It was, kind of easier to set up, required less investment, and enabled us to build relationships with clients and understand our client base better, but also to start demonstrating that there was real demand there. So you're constantly in the sort of early days, constantly trying to trade off, find as many real results as fast as you can, as cheaply as you can, and then build a community of funders and supporters around you.
That's interesting. This idea, I suppose, also of testing ideas or learning as much as you can in a short period at the beginning. Is there a discipline in testing, as it were, just seeing things as an opportunity to get more information and to further understand the problem, indeed?
Yeah, and there are kind of increasingly kind of the theoretical frameworks around this stuff. I can't say that we necessarily follow those as cookbooks, but here in Silicon Valley, for example, the notion of the lean startup is very popular and hot now. So it's this idea again of iterating quickly, starting with beta products and testing them, whether this is a sort of a mobile game or a piece of software or a social enterprise in Kenya. It's getting sort of iterating as quickly as you can, getting feedback from customers as quickly as you can. I mean, it seems intuitive, but that's not the way a lot of businesses are started. I think it's really effective, though, in this landscape. You see, again, organizations in the design industry like IDEO promoting these ideas of human-centered design, which have similar kinds of frameworks around them.
I mentioned that book to you yesterday, The Social Entrepreneur's Playbook. Well, Ian McMillan, he wrote a book in 1995 called Discovery Driven Growth, which was in the Harvard Business Review, and that fundamentally is the basis of the lean startup. You mentioned the importance of building a support team, or you talked about that. Can you talk about that a little bit? How did you do that, and how important has that been helping you as you've grown?
Yeah, I mean, I can't stress the value of having a strong team enough. I mean, you think about venture capitalists, a lot of them are investing just in the people more than the idea. And I think that's absolutely true in these settings where it's hard, I mean, where business is tough. You know, I mean, starting up an organization, you know, no matter what your purpose and executing on it really relies on the strength of the people that you have and the team that you have. And so we've been very, deliberate and opportunistic about that. But it's constantly, you know, it's sort of one of the things that you have to spend the most time thinking about. And, you know, part of it is trying to inspire people and kind of bring really talented people in. But then there's a lot of just, you know, the same sorts of things that a sports team would go through. It's thinking about what kinds of people you need in various roles and how to kind of trade up and develop them. I think we've managed to pull together a really phenomenal team of, we've grown to a team of 60 people in Kenya, and it's still small, but it's growing fast. And we have some really talented, talented managers and executives. And it's an interesting mix of people. Some guys who are coming from the States with strong experience in consulting, and also some really talented, and experienced Kenyan managers as well. So getting a kind of team that's, I think, in this landscape, increasingly with diaspora communities, you have an opportunity to create a strong kind of cosmopolitan team that builds on each other's strengths and diversity there. So we have our clinical operations director is a Kenyan who trained as a nurse in the U.S. and she was running hospitals in the U.S. and decided she wanted to kind of contribute to her country, and she moved her family back and joined us to run our clinical division. Really phenomenal Faith Mui guy. And so it's, I don't know, that's, that I think is the most sort of inspiring, exciting piece of this kind of work is getting and building a team of people who can execute on this.
So that's quite a big group. It says growing fast. What would you advise, say, to you know, somebody starting out that might not have necessarily strong connections in a particular area, how to go about, you know, building support, getting feedback, and so forth?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a mix of, this is sort of gets back to the bootstrapping idea, because it's hard when you start and you don't really have anything to show for yourself. So, you know, four years ago, it was just, you know, Decorando was just an idea, and you know, and you're faced with this issue of like, okay, well, I know if I just had money and I just had people behind me, we could do this easily. but you don't have either to begin with. And so it's this kind of balancing act, between kind of demonstrating real proof as quickly as possible. And that might be with, you know, with field surveys. It might be with sort of some initial client customer interactions that start to demonstrate your point. And then very quickly trying to trade that and leverage, getting resources. And when I think about, you know, the process that we went through, it's kind of a mix of being able to create a strong message around kind of connecting the dots between where you are now and where you need to be, and then building social proof. Because in the early days, I mean, so, you know, it's maybe getting one funder to support you, and then and bringing in advisors whose name adds credibility to your work, and it's bringing in, you know, your first team, which is probably not going to be your strongest team, because it's hard to sell really talented people on something that barely exists. So it's a constant kind of you're sort of trading up and evolving as quickly as you can, with the recognition that you have limited resources. I don't know if that's very clear, but.
Well, no, it's, I see, as you say, it's kind of an iterative thing. You've just got to keep pushing, but there are those things that you can do to, you know, to validate, I suppose, what you're doing as much as possible and as quickly as possible, I suppose. And I suppose, like any entrepreneur, the drive to continue, that's always important. I mean, for you, what have been the most difficult days? Have there been days where you questioned whether or not, you know, this was, would be viable? Can you give me an example or two of moments which were particularly challenging?
So I think the toughest days are when you encounter the kinds of challenges that in the healthcare landscape, for example, it's, you know, when you have a client complication or, you know, the nurses give the wrong diagnosis or, you know, there's criticism from clients, and that's going to happen inevitably. When you lose a funder or you lose a team member or run into a problem with the government, those kinds of things happen all the time. I mean, it's sort of you know, and they're interspersed with the highs of bringing great people onto the team and getting great feedback from your clients.
Can you talk a little bit about funding and your experience of funding Jacaranda Health and getting to where you are today?
So funding is one of those big, along with bringing in a team, sort of toughest thing to do at the very beginning when you don't really have anything to show for yourself. And so really what you need is someone to anchor you. And usually that's not much, you know, so you have to, you know, there are, I think, you know, as far as concrete suggestions, there are a couple of great funders out there that provide early stage support to social entrepreneurs. So, Echoing Green, the Milagro Foundation, the Puri Foundation, a few of these guys are out there looking for really great ideas. There's business plan competitions as well. And will provide seed support for organizations that are really just getting started off. But at the same time, you know, you've got to make as much progress as you can with as little as you can. And the reality for most of us is that, you know, you manage to convince someone to give you a $10,000 grant or a $15,000 grant and do as much as you can with a couple of interns and a few clients and then sort of leverage that into something bigger. What I've seen, some of the more successful social entrepreneurs now, there's a little bit more of an ecosystem and a pipeline for funding, starting with some of these seed funders. For us, it was a mix of, we were lucky enough to be involved with some of these guys like the Milagro and Puri Foundations and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation that support social entrepreneurs through these early days, but also, you know, some visionary family foundations that were just excited about the cause and the opportunity as well. You start out with small amounts of money and then you move into bigger ones. There's a similar ecosystem that's being built on the for-profit side as well. So, as I mentioned, I worked with the Acumen Fund. My point of departure was actually originally, hey, let's build this thing as a for-profit, and then sort of got convinced the other way. I see some great for-profit entrepreneurs in this space going through a similar trajectory on, you know, starting with angel funding. You know, they're increasingly, I think that's the toughest stage, but they're increasingly some guys who are willing to put convertible debt and early stage seed investments and sometimes even grants into startup for-profit entrepreneurs. And then increasingly as well, there are these guys who are coming in at the kind of Series A stage with venture-type investments, you know, with a kind of social flavor to them, looking for good deals in this space. Seed stage is always the toughest, but I feel like the sort of financing ecosystem is definitely evolving quickly.
That's excellent. You mentioned also the when things are good and there's great energy and great positive feeling. To what extent is that something that is really special about a social business, social enterprise, the sense that there is this deeper meaning, there is something more than money? Is that something that helps a team when things are difficult?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, that's absolutely true. You know, I think it is. You know, when you have a sort of a mission or you have something that inspires and sort of drives a lot of people to join the team, that's a kind of a capital. I mean, in other words, that's something that you can kind of trade off in terms of, it's like a benefit and a perk. And it does kind of keep people motivated. But it's not something, you know, having done this for a couple of years, it's not something you can bank on. And I think the nonprofit sector sometimes tried to bank too much on it, you know, at the expense of other things like compensation. and the reality is that, you know, I mean, there's plenty of guys working for Google and for-profit companies that are equally inspired by the mission. And you know, in our sector, you know, it's great. It's something that you can offer to people, and it helps bring people into the team. But you also have to be really smart on the human resources side about compensation, about flexibility, and some of the trade-offs that you can't provide as a for-profit organization, or, you know, equity and stock options and things like that. But in return, some of the things that you've got going for you are, or the things that sort of we in this sector end up doing are you're giving people more responsibility, giving them a little more flexibility. The mission is obviously a great inspirer, but it can't be the only thing, I think.
What about when things are tough? What for yourself, and I suppose even more broadly, what inspires you? Who inspires you? Are there any particular figures, individuals that have inspired you?
My answer to that would be the people that inspire me the most are our team, to be honest with you. So, you know, seeing these guys who are just tremendously committed, the nurses who are there kind of on the front lines in the middle of the night delivering babies, doing it tirelessly and ceaselessly, that makes it easier to get up in the morning when you know what people are, sort of lengths people are going to do their job and do it well. Our clients too, you know, the feedback was just, our clinical director was just sharing with me a note this morning from one of our clients who was just giving great feedback about the service that she received, you know, one of the nurse aides sort of rubbing her back in the middle of the night, you know, while she was in labor and getting callbacks or solicitous callbacks from our reception guys to make sure she was okay afterwards, you know, that kind of thing. Hearing their experiences and how it differs from their experience before is always, I think, an inspiration. I think, you know, for those of us sort of trying to tackle really difficult causes, you have to be inspired to and check back in with the need itself. In other words, it's kind of a kick in the pants, but people have been trying to solve maternal health and these global health problems for decades without a tremendous amount of success. And I think it can be easy to become complacent if sort of making sure that we recognize how far there still is to go can be an important motivator as well.
The makeup of a social entrepreneur, the character of a social entrepreneur, do you have any sense of what it takes? What kind of person will do well? Obviously, people from all kinds of realms of experience and expertise and so forth. Are there any commonalities, any few qualities that you think are really important to be a social entrepreneur?
That's a great question, Fergal. I was just at a retreat last week with a group of social entrepreneurs funded by the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation, which is a phenomenal organization that supports some very promising social entrepreneurs. And, you see a real mix, obviously. You know, there's a lot of the typical entrepreneurial characteristics, kind of persistence and stubbornness and a willingness to sort of see things that don't exist and be bothered by problems that are out there either in the market or in the sort of social sector. But, you know, the personalities vary a lot. You know, I think it's when you look at sort of leadership of companies in general, I mean, you know, you get some very kind of inspired and inspirational people who are kind of visionary types, and there's some real engineers and project manager types who are just like, this is a problem I see and I want to sort of, I have a background in accounting and I want to figure this out. Kind of operations guys as well as the sort of great talker or sort of visionary salespeople as well. And I think it's great that there's that kind of mix. I don't think there should be an archetype, honestly.
Absolutely. The future of Jacaranda Health, the vision, what's your sense? You mentioned you have 60 people today. What are the measures that you use to describe, I suppose, where you are today and what you've achieved, and what is your vision?
Yeah, that's a good one and a tough one too, because I think for us, that's evolved. We're actually at a state where that's evolving a bit. Our vision is to make an impact in maternal health, to reduce neonatal and maternal mortality. And I think the challenge. challenge is drawing, sort of connecting the dots between a particular business model and service provision at a local level and kind of a big and a big goal. And for us, our theory of change, I guess, is that we're building a network of hospitals, and our goal is to be one of the biggest providers of maternity care in the region. Building these hospitals and providing great direct service, starting in Nairobi and then moving into other other cities in East Africa. But at the same time, there's a kind of an imperative to be capturing what we're doing well. So building these systems that I mentioned, capturing what we're doing, and sharing it, sort of disseminating it and influencing the sector. Because frankly, if we're just a chain of 10 or 20 hospitals, that's a drop in the bucket, and I think that's true for a lot of people trying to deal with, whether you're building schools or hospitals, your ability to directly influence the population is just, we would delivering 20 or 30,000 babies is a tiny percentage of the total market. So the only way that we're really going to budge the needle on maternal health is through influence. And there are a couple of different ways to get there, and we're still in the process of kind of figuring it out as we are sort of demonstrating and proving our direct service model, building the systems. We're also looking at, okay, so how do we take this kind of better model and get it replicated and adapted and scaled up in the public sector amongst the private sector in maternal healthcare in Kenya and beyond. And there's a couple of, and I think some of the smart and most successful social enterprises out there have figured out how to do that, either through advocacy and policy setting or through kind of strong partnerships, franchises and through other organizations that are able to operate at scale. So that I think is one of the trickiest and most interesting questions, is how you take a kind of a direct service model and figure out how to kind of catalyze change in the broader ecosystem.
Absolutely.
So we'll check back in with me once we figure it out.
Yes, this idea of transferring insights and knowledge and expertise within social and other organizations is clearly very powerful. You mentioned that there have been, it's a challenging area, maternity health, and other people have had a go at it and so forth, or even doing it in different ways. Are there one or two insights that you've had that, I guess, support your approach and that allow you to operate? I think you gave me some figure of, is it a fifth of the cost of private hospitals? What is it that you've learned?
One point that struck me is that I think sometimes in the social enterprise space, there's an assumption that just reaching scale is enough. And I think that can be a little bit of a trap. In other words, that you have a successful business model, and that's enough. That delivering care better and cheaper is going to somehow, sort of result in other people following that that model. That it's, if you build a successful chain of schools or something like that, that's automatically going to translate into kind of impact in the sector. I think that's actually not true. And this issue of influence actually requires there's a work stream around that. There's strategies required to do that, and actually requires effort. And I think that's one of the challenging things for for-profit social enterprises is that it's hard to build that into your margins, that influence piece. And that's one of the areas where I'd like to see the sector kind of focused a little more effort on, is what are some of the most successful examples of how people take successful models, whether it's delivering healthcare more cost-effectively or whether it's delivering a better model for education or sort of agricultural inputs. And
very, very rich area, because there's so many proliferation of organizations now doing different things, and I guess to identify what works really well there and how transferable it is and how to transfer it could really have a multiply, leverage the impact. Is there anything that you wanted to say about what you're doing that you think is inspiring?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything to add, Fergal, besides, the fact that I think it's really exciting to see that there are so many people getting into this space, that this idea of social entrepreneurship has become, it's sort of gone into becoming currency as a language. And you see, I see university students and guys, and most excitingly to me, guys in in Kenya, you know, sort of college kids and you know, business owners and stuff starting to think about starting businesses themselves. I mean, I am and continue to be really keen to see more of these things originate. It's kind of where the work is, and I think you know, and I see a lot of promise in places like Nairobi, where you get increasingly people starting to launch their own businesses locally that are addressing some of these issues.
Well, thank you very much, and I wish you the very best with Jacaranda Health. But thank you for sharing your inspiring stories and experience with us today.
Thanks, Fergal. It was great speaking to you, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur Podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.